Here's the Mormon clipboard here from last Friday, so you can see that these guys are very nice young men, and they don't bite, and they're fun to talk to. So I have urged all of you, every single one of you, to call your local Mormon church and have two missionaries come by for orange juice and talk to them about Jesus. And it really actually works. They're wide open. I don't know of anybody in church in the 19, 20-year-old age group that's as open as these kids are. And they're too young to have been totally brainwashed with Mormonism, so I think they're very eligible to be evangelized. So that's fun. That's a real high point of my week on Friday. They used to come over for an hour, and now it's stretching on to 2 hours. And it used to be two of them, and now it's four or six of them. So I asked them if they were going to gang up on me and kidnap me, and they said they weren't. We're in Job, and we're in the second week of Job. And last week we did the first two chapters. They're on my website. They're podcast. And the sermon notes from Ray Stedman are excellent. There's 14 full notes, a whole book by Ray. All the classes in Ray's really superb on this. But some of you weren't here last week, and that means that you can do a makeup exam and bring a note from home with an excused absence if you want. And let me just quick give you a little synopsis. Of course, a week is such a long time, you've probably forgotten the whole thing anyway. But Job is probably the oldest book in the Bible. This man lived probably something, maybe 4,000 years ago, perhaps in the patriarchal age, or maybe sometime after Abraham, before Moses, before the law, before Israel. And yet he has a profound and deep understanding of God. And that's interesting. I mentioned how difficult the manuscript is, how complicated the Hebrew is with foreign words and difficult words, and how hard to interpret it is. There are a couple of good verse-by-verse commentaries. I found one by Francis Anderson that's really good if you want to go verse-by-verse. Ray is very good to give you the overview. Roy Zook from Dallas has a print, out-of-print commentary on Job, and I've sort of been looking around. I always like to add to my library. I found a recent rabbinical translation, fresh from the Hebrew, and it wasn't very good. And I think that's because you have to read Job with a little bit of sanctified intuition, and you have to kind of let the Spirit shed the light on things. So if I'm reading along and your translation does not agree with my New King James, it's just because it's difficult Hebrew. And let's see if you have major objections, well, you can yell and throw tomatoes or whatever you want. Job lived in what is now Jordan, maybe in southern Jordan, maybe in eastern Jordan, in the land of Uz. We seem to know that fairly well circumstantially. And we're told in the first five verses quite a bit about this man. It's what really represents God's point of view of him. He's blameless. He's a very godly man. He avoids evil very carefully, and blameless, of course, doesn't mean sinless. It means that he has no sin in his life that he hasn't dealt with, no known sin in his life. So that's God's view of him. He's a justified man, justified by his faith, like we are. He has seven sons and three daughters. He is such a good father that when his sons have a birthday party, he offers an animal sacrifice, a sin offering for each of his sons, just to cover any sins they may accidentally, inadvertently have committed during the year, which is kind of awesome if I have got kind of a dad. He's a very rich man with 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys and many, many servants, and he's the greatest of the men, the patriarchs in that area and in that time. He's very well known. And so the first five verses give us a picture of this incredible man and his wealth and his reputation and his godly life. And he's had seven sons and three daughters, so he's, I don't know how old we can guess, but he's not a kid anymore. He's a pretty grown man. Now, something very unusual happens beginning at verse 6. It's very, very unusual in that we are given a behind-the-scenes view of things from that standpoint of the invisible world of the spiritual. We're ushered into the presence of God, and we see things that are going on between God and the angels and Satan that ordinarily we would be totally unaware of. And in fact, Job is totally unaware of this information that we're being given at the beginning of the book. So we have some secrets here that Job doesn't know anything about. And it's not very often that God shows a person what's going on in the invisible world. All day long we're influenced by angels and by God, but we don't know about all that. Probably a good idea that we don't. You know, you get to Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation, we have these kind of behind-the-scenes glimpses into the heavenlies that apply to Israel and the nations, but this is the only book where we get it for an individual. And we find, also we can first clear a picture of the adversary here, Ha-Satan, the Satan, the adversary, one of the Beno Elohim, one of the angels. And so there's this scene in heaven where the angels come periodically before God and Satan comes into the presence of God. That's kind of startling because some people wouldn't imagine that God would dialogue with Satan. Satan actually has been thrown out of his office as the prime minister of the universe. He did that when he rebelled against God, and his fall takes place in seven stages. He's thrown out of his office as prime minister, but he has limited access to heaven, and his territory is on the earth. He's the God of this world. He goes to and fro on the earth, and when the Lord asks him where he's been, he says, "I've been running to and fro on the earth, stirring up trouble." We find in the book of Revelation that at a future day, Satan will be thrown out of heaven altogether, and his domain and territory will be the earth only, at which point he's furiously angry, John says, because he knows his time is short. So then in the book of Revelation, we find that later on, Satan is thrown into a bottomless pit for 1,000 years, and he sort of has to sulk there for 1,000 years until the end of the millennial kingdom, and then he's finally thrown into the lake of fire. So his doom, which is guaranteed from the beginning, is in stages. And he's now in the stage where he has access to God, limited access to God. Right away, we see that Satan isn't another God. He's a created being. He has very limited freedom. He has to do everything by getting God's permission. He has to obey God. He can't go further than God lets him go, which is kind of reassuring. God's in charge, God's sovereign, and if Satan does something, it's with God's permission. We don't always know why. Now, this book involves a great deal of suffering, and this does not explain all suffering. It only explains one particular situation. And at first, it will seem that this suffering is purposeless, that maybe God and Satan are having a little game between them, and Job's the victim of that little game. But that's not the truth. That's really not true, as we'll see. There really is purpose in God allowing the suffering that Job endures. The devil, God's the one who initiates the conversation with Job. God brings it up. Have you considered my man Job down there, how he's blameless and upright and godly and fears me? And Satan says, "Oh, I don't believe that. His motives are probably wrong." Naturally, if I was rich like that, anybody who's rich and protected by you would fear you and respect you, but it's fake. If he had some real tests, he would curse you. And God said, "Okay, go at him." And in one day, a whole series of calamities fell on Job, and he lost his seven sons and his three daughters in a lightning strike on in the house, perhaps, some disaster. Raiders came in from Iraq and from Arabia and ran off with all of his animals and killed all of his servants. In one day, his fortune is reduced to zero. Does he curse God as Satan said he would? Nope, he doesn't. Score, Job 1, Satan 0. Well, that's not enough for Satan. He says, sometimes people can handle adverse financial situations and loss of property, but you touch his life a little bit, give him a little bit of physical misery, and then he'll curse you. And God says, okay, give that a try. Now we get the next a scene of terrible pain and ugly, awful sores coming to Job, in which he's now physically miserable with ugly boils all over his body, and he's longs to die, and is sitting out in the ash heap with a piece of pottery scraping his oozing boils because he's so miserable. And does he curse God? Nope. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Pretty awesome that you can handle that much devastation all at once. We had a little remark in here at the end of chapter 2 about his wife, Mrs. Job, and I mentioned that I would love to hear Mrs. Job's side of this whole story, because what mother could stand the loss of all of her children in one day and the loss of her house and her servants and everything in one day and not be totally devastated, maybe even more deeply than Job? So when we get to heaven, there'll be a long line of people wanting to talk to Job, but I want to go talk to Mrs. Job because I'd like to see how it felt from her point of view. What she does say to her husband is interesting. In chapter 3, his wife said to him, "Do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die." That's kind of that's exactly, of course, what Satan's accusation was. She doesn't know that, and I think she's just kind of in great pain and misery, and he treats her gently. He just says, "You're a foolish woman." It means you don't have all the facts, really. I don't think he's being harsh with her, but he's got a lot of things to handle, and she's going through her own crisis, and that's about all we hear about her for a while. Now, the next thing we find out is that the news has gotten out on the Morning Jordan Tribune, the Uz Tribune Limited Mercury, and it's gotten out by email, and CNN has captured the story of this wealthy man who's lost all of his property and his health, and he's sitting in a pile of ashes, and nobody can explain this horrific disaster that's happened to their leading citizen. So all the reporters rush out there. No, but Job's best friends do. Three of his really neat friends he's grown up with that are also godly men, supposedly. And they come out, and they come out with the right motives. In chapter 2, verse 11, they made an appointment, and they came together to mourn with him and to comfort him. So they came to Job with the right motives. They wanted to identify with Job in his suffering and misery. That's good. And they wanted to comfort him. Did they succeed in doing that? Nope. The worst calamity of all is probably Job putting up with his three friends, as we'll see. And his three friends don't get a very good report card when this is all over with, but I don't want to give away all the secrets. So is that okay for the summary where we are? All right. Job has been sitting 7 days in ashes, and his friends have been sitting there 7 days around him. I suppose they eat and sleep and things like that, but 7 days go by with nobody saying one word. And that would suggest that his three friends are overwhelmed and don't have anything to say, and Job doesn't have anything to say, and 7 days go by. So what a devastated man he is. What a horrific situation when they come and see their best friend reduced to this level of misery, this ash heap. Okay? Right? Now, how does Job handle this? Chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Job spoke and said, "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived." He's kind of talking about the night he was conceived, and then 9 months later, when he was born, and he says, "It was a cursed, terrible day when I was conceived. It was an awful, dark day when I was born." And he's going to go on and tell us how bad it really was that he ever came into the world in the first place. I don't know if you've ever had that happen to you. You've been in a place where you say, "I wish I'd never been born." Well, that's what he's thinking here. May that day, the day of my birth, be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, may darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year. Let's take that day out of the calendar. Take my birthday out of the calendar. And just pretend it never even happened. May it not come into the number of the months. Oh, may that night be barren. I wish his mother had had a miscarriage instead here. He says, make no joyful shout come into it. Then he appeals to sorcerers. He appeals to sort of magicians and sorcerers. He says, may those people who utter curses, who put cast spells, or who have power even to arouse the great serpent Leviathan, may they curse the day that I was born. He's kind of invoking all of the supernatural powers to go on his side and curse the day of his birth. That's where this is one of those places where the Hebrew gets a little skewer. May the stars of its morning be dark, may it look for light but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes. Any number of things could have prevented me from being born, and none of them happened, and here I am, and what a terrible tragedy it is that I'm even here. That's how he feels. Is it wrong to feel that way? No. It's pretty harsh on yourself at this point. It's kind of heartfelt what he really feels like in his heart. Now, he's got a little more. Why did I not die at birth? Why wasn't I stillborn? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me, or the breasts that I should nurse? In the ancient world, of course, before they had abortions, an unwanted baby was just left out in the wilderness to die. So if you have a child that you don't like or it's the wrong sex, you just toss the baby out in the field and it'll die in a few days. Pretty horrific, but then abortion's horrific too. And Job's now wishing that he'd been abandoned by his own mother. For now, if that had happened, if I had died as a small child, an infant, I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep, and I would have been at rest. Now, here we have the early Old Testament view of death as Sheol, as the grave, or the underworld. This is not all differentiated into heaven and hell. And the grave is simply what happens when you die. You just go to this underworld, the good and the bad, and everybody goes there, and it's a place where you kind of forget everything, and it's just a shadowy world, and that's what he's wishing. He wishes he could join the dead. And he says that he talks about what it's like to be in Sheol. He says, if he was dead, he'd be with kings and counselors of the earth who had built them great palaces for themselves that were now in ruins. He would be with princes who had gold, who had filled their houses with silver, because death is the great leveler. And when you die, you don't take anything with you. And rich and poor are all on equal footing in the grave. And that's the company he wants to be with. Why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor, the small and the greater there, and the servant is free from his master. See, that death is the great leveler. Rich and poor, prisoner and slave and free, young and old, anybody that when you die, it's all levels right out. And that's where he wants to be, in the company of people that have died. Now, we have to remember that as we read further in the Bible, we get more and more and more information on the afterlife. And so this is a kind of primitive patriarchal understanding of Sheol, the grave, without making any other distinctions. Verse 20, little section here. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter soul who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures? If you're having a real hard time and you want to die but you can't die, and you have enough clarity of insight and understanding, is it fun? Makes it worse, kind of, to have your mind working and trying to figure all this out, and to have your emotions to deal with, and to be in the situation where you realize you're not going to die and you got to cope with it. Kind of awful situation here. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? In chapter 1, we found out that in our little behind-the-scenes lesson that God had hedged in Job and was protecting him from evil. And that was part of the reason that he was so blessed, is he was protected by God. And that's good. But now Job turns that around and he wants to accuse God of hedging him in for evil. He feels hedged in. He feels God's protection. And he also is totally aware of God's sovereignty. So he's not accusing God of doing something wrong. He just doesn't understand it. Is that okay so far? Kind of get it? Hope you do. My sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. Have dinner, but not enjoy it. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest. Trouble comes. Or really, in Hebrew, trouble keeps coming. How's that? It kind of adequately describe how he feels. I think it does. I think it gets this. Maybe we can hardly identify with it, but I'm sure you've had bad days. And is it okay to tell people this? Is it okay to talk to God like this? Is this insulting to God? No, it isn't. He knows this is from God. He's not accusing God of doing anything wrong. He's just hopelessly frustrated. And he desperately wants somebody to please explain this to him. Well, his friends will explain it to him very nicely, starting with Eliphaz. Three friends, that we think the oldest one is Eliphaz. Ray calls Eliphaz the eloquent. The next guy is Bildad, and Ray Stedman calls him Bildad the brutal. And the last guy is... Who's the last guy? Zophar the zealous. So that kind of gets it, because they're very different in the way they approach the problem. But as you'll see, they all have the same kind of answers for Job. And here's Eliphaz, and he now speaks up, and he's polite. If one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Is it okay if I talk to you a little bit, Job? I really can't contain myself. I got to tell you how I feel. Is that all right? Polite, isn't it? Maybe. It starts out polite. Now, his first, there's actually structure in each of these little speeches. I won't bother to go into it, but in the next little section, he says, "Surely, Job, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees. But now it comes upon you, and you are weary. It touches you, and you are troubled. Is not your reverence your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" Now, what's he saying? Job, you've given great advice to people. I've seen you help hurting friends. I've seen you encourage people who are in big trouble. Okay, your problem is you need to take your own advice. You're smart enough to know about God, so just teach yourself what you've been teaching others. It's not exactly appropriate, is it? That's not a lot of empathy in that. There's not a lot of compassion. These three guys don't sit down and listen to Job sympathetically and compassionately. They all fail to give the compassion and the empathy, and they all get the wrong answers. I'm sneaking you ahead, and that'll dissuade you from reading the rest of the book, but can't do that. All right, verse 7. Remember now, big sermon now, we get his big sermon. This is what he believes. Remember now, what person ever perished who was innocent? Or where were the upright ever cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his anger they are consumed. The roaring of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, and the teeth of the young lions are broken. The old lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. There's his basic philosophy. You never see innocent people suffering. Therefore, you can't be innocent. Is that true? No, that's not true. Innocent people do suffer. And he's already come to a judgment here that Job has sinned, and he's getting the reward of some sin in his life that must be pretty big, and God's punishing him for his sin. Wrong. According to my experience, based on what I know, yeah, my opinion, yeah, I've got to figure it out. I want to put it to you really gently. Bottom line is, you've sinned, Job, And as soon as you repent, God will fix it. And so that's all we got to do. It's real easy to fix this one. That's the idea. Well, that's totally wrong, turns out. Turns out it is. But so that's not very helpful. Not helpful at all. Did you ever have somebody come and preach to you, and they give you a whole bunch of truth, but it didn't fit your situation? It was totally irrelevant? What an annoying thing that is, you know. What an annoying thing to have somebody just lay a whole bunch of truth in you and it doesn't fit at all. It's just irrelevant to what you're going through. Just makes it all the worse. Now, Eliphaz says, I had a dream once. Let me tell you about my dream. I want to just share from my own experiences with the Lord. A word was secretly brought to me, and my ear perceived a whisper of it. In disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me in trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit passed before my face. The hair on my body stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance, its ghost in his dream. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. And then the voice said, the voice of this ghost, can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? God puts no trust in his servants. If he charges his angels with error, how much more those who dwell in the houses of clay, us human beings? So God is just, and he's moral, and he's great, and he's mighty, and we're all lesser created beings. And which one of us has a case that we can bring against God and prove God wrong? And our foundations as men is in the dust. We're easily crushed like a moth, and broken in pieces until morning, from morning to evening. Men perish forever with no one regarding them. Does not their own excellence go away? They die even without wisdom. How about us frail human beings? We're kind of at the mercy of God, and we're frail and infallible. So why should we complain? Man is just made out of dust. So man's a maggot. You know, we're all this kind of maggots. Didn't you see that in there? That kind of... God is just, but he's impersonal. So it turns out that these three friends actually have the same root problem that Job, it turns out, has. A God who is righteous and just, but remote and impersonable and untouchable. It does sound like Allah a little bit, doesn't it? It does sound a little bit. Islam isn't around then, but it does sound like that. But there's an awful lot of people who have this idea about God, that God's remote, and he's in charge, but he's impersonal, and he can't identify with our sufferings and our hurts, and he's indifferent. That's a problem. Verse chapter 5. Call out now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Job, who are you going to pray to? You want to pray to one of the angels? Do you think one of the angels could help you? Wrath kills a foolish man, and envy slays a simple one. He's sort of insinuating that Job is furious at God, and you ought not to be furious at God. That's kind of tempting fate. And you better be really careful, because God might just zap you down. Now here's a low blow. I've seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. His sons are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. There's no deliverer, because the hungry eat up his harvest, taking it even from the thorns, and a snare snatches their substance. Affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble spring from the ground. Yet man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. Again, the Hebrew is a little difficult here. The idea is, Job, how come all of your sons and your daughters got killed? That's because of your sin, too. So you brought this on yourself, and you brought this on your family. Wrong. Boy, that's really nasty. Even if it were true, would you say that at this point? And no, you wouldn't. You'd be discreet about it. But as for me, says this fine friend, as for me, I would seek God. Implying, of course, that Job hasn't been seeking God. To God I would commit my cause, God who does great things, unsearchable, marvelous things without number, some wonderful theology here now. God gives rain on the earth, and He sends waters on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands cannot carry out their plans. He catches the wise in their own craftiness. Quoted in 1 Corinthians 3:19 by Paul. The counsel of the cunning comes quickly upon them. They meet with darkness in the daytime, grope at noontime as in the night. But He saves the needy from the sword, from the mouth of the mighty, and from their hand. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth. Once again, he's a little bit convinced that the innocent do not suffer unless it's from sin. That innocent people are always protected. Not so. The just people are always safe. No, that's not so. God does not always save the needy from the sword. Got some of the theology's right. He knows that God is just and mighty and powerful. So Eliphaz has got some of his theology is okay. Verse 17. Job, what's really happening here is that God's chastening you. He wants you to repent, and so here's that. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. That's quoted in Hebrews. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. That's Hebrews 12 right there. And it is true that God chastens His own sons, but is Job being chastened? Nope. It's not what's going on. Job has not sinned. He's not being chastened. Wrong answer. Sound theology, wrong answer, inappropriate. Bad. The harm of bashing somebody over the head with truth that doesn't apply to their situation. This guy's getting himself in deep trouble, as we'll see. For God bruises, I do not despise the chastening of the Almighty, for He bruises, but He binds up. He wounds, but His hands make whole. He shall deliver in 6 troubles. In 7, no evil shall touch you. In famine, He shall redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the scourge of the tongue. You shall not be afraid of destruction when it comes. You shall laugh at destruction and famine. And you shall not be afraid of the beasts of the earth. If you just repent, it's all God's going to fix everything. That's all you got to do. Very simple. You shall have a covenant with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you. You shall know that your tent is in peace. You shall visit your habitation and find nothing amiss. As if you could turn back history and he could get up from the ash heap and go back and find his wife, his sons, and his family intact and all of his estate restored, as if that was what was going to happen next, if he just repent. That's nonsense. You don't recover from this kind of disaster with some kind of miraculous restoration of what you had before. And that's his advice here. You shall come to the grave at a full age. You got a long life ahead of you. You can have a great, grand life. Job doesn't see that, of course, and we can't either at this point. Doesn't look like he has much of a future. You shall come to the grave at a full age as a sheaf of grain ripens in its season. Behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear it and know for yourself. Take my advice. I know I've got the answer for you here. Job, now I've given you my best advice. And Job says, thank you very much. That hit the nail right on the head. That was just perfect. I feel 1,000 times better now. Well, no, that's not it. Job is furious. Chapter 6. Job answered and said, oh, that my grief were fully weighed and my calamity laid with it in the balances. You only made my situation worse. For then it would have been heavier than the sand of the sea. If you could take my grief and sorrow and weigh it on a balance, you'd find that my grief weighs more than all the sand on the seashore. Wrong metaphor there. Therefore my words have been rash. The arrows of the Almighty are within me. My spirit drinks in the poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray when it has grass, or the ox low over its fodder? Can flavorless food be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. There is loathsome food to me. Everything in life that you'd ordinarily enjoy is now tasteless and bland and doesn't feel like eating or anything like that. And it's God. God's the one who's put him in this situation. Oh, that I might have my request that God would grant me the thing that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have comfort, though in anguish I would exult. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. I haven't done anything wrong. So far, I'm not aware of any sin that I need to repent of. I stand on my previous convictions that I'm a just man before God. So I'm not admitting the charges that you, Eliphaz, have made against me. They're not true, best I know. What strength do I have that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones? Or is my flesh bronze? Is my help not within me and my success driven from me? You guys think that my heart is as hard as a rock? Or that I'm as strong as bronze, that I can't be touched by life's afflictions? No, he's vulnerable and hurting. To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Even if I had forsaken God, even if I had turned away from God, I wish you guys would show me a little kindness. You get that? See that in there? He's pretty frank about his reaction to Eliphaz's preaching here. My brothers, that's you guys, it sounds like he's heard from all three of them because they're all three much alike. And he says, my brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook, like the streams of the brooks that pass away, which are dark because of the ice and into which the snow vanishes. In the desert country where you get sudden flash floods, on one day you'll have a great flood and everything's washed away, and then suddenly the water's all gone, and there's a fickleness in nature in that in regard to how you get the thunderstorms in the desert. And then he says, but when it's warm, when the storm goes over, the desert's all dry right up, and the water vanishes, and the paths are turned aside, and when the caravans come through the desert land, they can't find any drinking water even for sustenance. So that's what it's like on the desert. You have either too much water or not enough water. And that's sort of like the fickleness of Mother Nature out in the desert. And he compares that to the deceitfulness that he's finding in his friends here. Now you are nothing. Verse 21. For now you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid. Did I ever say, bring something to me? Have I ever done the following things? Have I ever said, bring something to me? Have I ever asked you for anything? Or have I ever offered anybody a bribe? Have I ever failed to help a friend when he came to me in time of need? Have I ever helped somebody who needed to be redeemed or somebody that was in trouble and I helped them? So he's kind of defending his character and his reputation, which is fine. He's not guilty. I'm not guilty as charged. That's kind of the idea here. The other thing in here is I don't owe you guys anything. I've not done anything for you guys that puts me in debt to you at all. Teach me, and I will hold my tongue. If you guys can really tell me what's wrong with me, I'd be all too open to hearing that. I'm really open to having you help me. I really want your help. Cause me to understand wherein I've erred. Please tell me what I've done wrong and what's wrong with my relationship with God and why this happened. Can you really help me? So that's honest. How forceful are right words? How forceful are right words? When you're really telling the truth in love and it's the real truth, that gets right into the heart. And Eliphaz hasn't said anything that gets to Job's heart, just made him mad. What does your arguing prove? Prove that you're a great theologian, I guess. Do you intend to reprove my words and the speeches of a desperate one, which are as wind? Yes, you overwhelm the fatherless and you undermine your friend. Pretty strong to tell Eliphaz that he's undermining his friend. That's kind of frank talk. Now, therefore, be pleased to look at me. I would never lie to your face. Turn now, let there be no injustice. Yes, turn again. My righteousness still stands. As far as I know, my relationship with God is just fine, and I haven't sinned, and I haven't done anything wrong, and if there's something wrong, you haven't pointed it out to me yet, and so he's even more frustrated. My righteousness still stands. Is there injustice on my tongue? Can my taste discern the unsavory? Okay? Chapter 7. It's a kind of a soliloquy now. Job's kind of answered, yeah. What happens when, I think it's very easy to jump to the conclusion when a disaster has come upon a brother or a sister, the first thing you think is, what have they done wrong? And you kind of look down, it's easy to get self-righteous and say, well, that's never happened to me. And we got to look and find out what they've done wrong so we can help them fix it, because it's got to be a result of sin. That's pretty easy to judge somebody just kind of automatically and look down on them. But we no. Talk about logs and specks. We've got some here. The little soliloquy in chapter 7. Is there not a time of hard service for man on earth? Are his days also like the days of a hired man, like a servant who earnestly desires the shade, and like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages? So I have allotted months of futility, and wearisome nights have now been appointed to me. I worked hard to build my family and my estate and my reputation, and it's all been gone away from me. It's all taken away from me, and it's all in vain. And now I've got this. I get these sleepless nights. Wearisome nights have been appointed to me. So this says about Job's present situation. He says, when I lie down, it dreads sleep coming upon him. Hamlet, Shakespeare. Dread falling asleep because of the nightmares that will come and get you. But you got to go to sleep, but you're afraid to go to sleep. It says, when I lie down, I say, when am I going to arise? And when will the night be ended? I've had my fill of tossing until dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. Boils won't go away. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. O God, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of whom God sees, the eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. In other words, I'm perishing, God. And if you're going to look at my situation and give me some answers, there's not a lot of time. If you know, maybe you're busy doing other things. If you could just take a little look at my fragile situation now. That's kind of, I think, that helplessness he feels. If you don't help me now or soon, I'm beyond help. That's kind of the urgency here. While your eyes are upon me, before I shall no longer be. As the cloud disappears and vanishes away, so he who goes down to the grave does not come up. Once I'm dead, it's going to be a little late for you to help me, God. Of course, he's been wishing to die, but then he says, if I was dead, then how in the world can you fix my situation? he shall never return. The man who's died will never return to his house, nor shall his place know him anymore. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? When I say, my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint. Then you scare me with nightmares, and you terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone. My days are but a breath. Still wants to die, only now he wants to die even more. But if he's going to live, he needs some help right now. What is man that you should magnify him? That you should set your heart on him? That sound familiar? That's quoted in Hebrews 2. That you should visit him every morning? Who is man? Not look away from me and let me alone until I swallow my saliva. He's so aware of that God's looking at him and watching him, and he can't hide from God. God, if you just turn your eyes away so I could just kind of compose myself and swallow my saliva. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression? If in case I really have sinned, why don't you just forgive me, please? So that way I won't be a burden to myself anymore. Take away my iniquity. For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me diligently, and I'm going to no longer be. You're going to come looking for me, and I'll be dead. So, how's that? That's kind of anguish compounded now, isn't it? Okay, that comes now. We're ready for the next comforting friend to come along. And that's what we'll do next week. How about some thoughts here? Oh, yes. No. Is this sort of, did everybody get the same thing that I got out of this kind of? You sort of see through the obscure Hebrew verse a little bit. It's poetry, you know. And it's difficult Hebrew. Kind of get the idea. Job is righteous. He hasn't sinned. He's in terrible anguish. His first friend hasn't helped him. He's made it worse. Yeah, if you're doing really well in life, you then the devil doesn't have a lot he can do to you. But when you're down and out, then he just loves to make it worse. What does Satan want? What is Satan after all in this whole thing? He wants Job to curse God. He's going to push Job to the absolute limit because Satan is convinced that in the end, Job will curse God. And so far, Job hasn't said one thing against God. That's right. Very careful at that point. Yeah. Isn't that common today that God's only there to bless us? And we don't deserve any hard times or struggles, this kind of prosperity gospel stuff. Yeah. Well, we have to see at the end of the book when God tells us how he sees this conversation and if does God find fault in Job. We'll see if God says, well, Job, you really messed up at verse 21. But we'll see. Steve, how about if you close this today?